And so I really, really, really cannot stress enough how much good has come from celebrating what makes me different from other people.
Welcome to Mission Critical, a podcast about the big picture, the purpose, and the values that drive today's most game-changing companies, entrepreneurs, and leaders. I'm your host, Lance Chung, Editor-in-Chief of Glory Media, and I'll be introducing you to a group of brilliant minds who are making an impact on the world and forging the path ahead. While they may all be very different from each other, the question remains the same. What's your mission?
Hi, Lauren. How are you today?
Hi. I'm so excited to be here. Well, kind of with you.
I'm so excited for our chat today. I've been looking forward to it and just been so excited just from doing my research. And it's just always so great to also be talking to like another Canadian and one that's doing so much great work beyond our borders too. So I'm just so happy that we can chat today.
Oh, thanks. Same sentiments about you. When I was kind of looking into things, I was like, oh my God, this roster is amazing and so Canadian. And then I figured you must be, of course, looked up Glory and all the good things. So holy smokes, so happy to be here.
I am really excited to chat today because I think there's a lot of really interesting themes that we can discuss and unpack. And so our podcast is really about mission and purpose. And that kind of goes into different areas of, you know, your work, whether that's as a model or your former career in media, or as a fashion entrepreneur. So I kind of want to hit on a lot of those things and just see what your perspective is.
Yeah, I think that that's so well aligned with me. The way that I make sense of having so many different roles throughout my career is that they're all oriented around the same mission. And that mission has always been to make folks who look and feel like me and have been excluded from fashion and thereby our culture feel included and represented and empowered and celebrated. And whether I've been a model or a brand founder or an editor or what have you, whatever I'll be next, it has always and will always feed back to that mission.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can see that in your body of work. And on that note, I wanted to start off with asking you, what is your favorite, most cherished memory you have where you felt the most beautiful?
Gosh, that's such a good question. Wow, I was not expecting that off the bat.
Jumping right into the deep end.
Wow. Well, I've been feeling really beautiful lately. Over the past, I guess, year and a bit now, have been going through a personal journey of coming out. And it has really made me feel in my body so much more like myself, so much more, and has made me feel beautiful in that it has helped me melt away a lot of the things I thought I should be or feel like or look like. And so being out, being gay, you know, being in the female gaze really makes me feel comfortable. And I think to me, that's where the beauty lies.
Yeah. I love that. And, you know, as someone that has worked in multiple areas of the fashion industry, from being a magazine editor at Glamour to a fashion entrepreneur to model, how do you define beauty and what it means to be beautiful? And also, how's that definition changed for you over the years?
Yeah, I think that beauty, it's a shame that honestly, beauty is the same word for a bunch of different things that it means. That's where I feel it gets a little mucky and difficult as a person who identifies as a woman in this culture to be constantly, you know, critiqued and marketed to, et cetera, et cetera. And so to me, there's one beauty, let's call it apples, that is the industry, right? And I work within that industry, so I'm very involved in it. Then there's another type of beauty, let's call it oranges, that is my personal experience of beauty within myself, others, the world. And like I said, unfortunately, I just think it's such a disservice to all of our mental health that they are called the same thing, because they cannot be more opposite in my eyes. And so to me, personal beauty is a thing of comfort and celebration and expression and peace. And I feel that way now in my 30s after having spent so much time kind of combating who I am and what I look like to fit into the rigidity of what our Apple beauty is. And so feeling at peace and calm and like I'm luxuriating in my differences is what beauty means to me now.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the apples to oranges comparison because it is so true. Like it is not a monolithic kind of conversation that we're having. There's so much nuance and subtleties to that conversation and that dialogue that we have. But on that note, like what do you think is the most interesting conversation we're having today about what it means to be beautiful in the industry?
I think that the most interesting thing that we're talking about in terms of beauty, as it equates to like valuableness, value. It's just value. It's not value in people is about intersectionality. And so at least in my part of the industry wherein I'm a plus size model, it really used to be, as you said, monolithic, homogenous, whatever you want to call it. There was one type of plus size ideal. At large, there was also one type of beauty ideal, you know? And I feel that there's so much diversity in who and what we celebrate now. And so you don't just have to be curvy, but in all the right places, right? You don't just have to be curvy, but a white person. And so I think that that is allowing so much more room for different folks, different conversations, perspectives, and all of the diversity that that generates is what is moving the industry forward in terms of progress.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you've had your work published in outlets like Vogue, Interview, and T Magazine, and also worked at Glamour as a fashion features editor where you oversaw the fashion team. What are your biggest takeaways that you took from your career in media that have really helped you in this next leg of your career journey?
Definitely that carving out your own niche is the fast lane. And I did not think that when I started. I wanted to be like all of the editors that I had seen come before me. I wanted to dress like them, talk like them, do what they did on the weekends, cover what they covered, and certainly not be the big girl in the room. And so even though I had had experience, of course, as someone bigger than most of my peers most of my life, as a plus size model professionally ahead of starting in media, I walked through the doors at Condé Nast that first day and said, that's all behind me. I'm like everyone else in here now. I'm going to assimilate and I don't want to be othered.
Yeah.
I did that for, I used that strategy for a while and I just didn't get anywhere. Surprise, surprise. If you act like everyone else, you're going to get what everyone else gets. And I just wasn't getting ahead in the way that I wanted to. And so I decided to lean into what made me different, which was in that context, my size, and start writing about it and talking about it. And lo and behold, most of America is in the same boat as me in terms of size and fashion and beauty and et cetera, et cetera. And it worked. And so from there, I really, really, really saw everything snowball. And I went from writing like 20 word captions at the back of the magazine to having a print column, a digital vertical. I was put on national TV shows to talk about inclusive fashion on behalf of the magazine. I got to design a clothing collection as part of the magazine's collaboration with a retailer called Lane Bryant. And then I went on to start my own business. And so I really, really, really cannot stress enough how much good has come from celebrating what makes me different from other people.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to actually touch on, you know, what you mentioned about, you know, finding your niche as well in a moment. But when you say that, like, because coming from someone that's also on the media side as well, I think what is really interesting and the things that really stand out from my end is like people that have a very distinct point of view in perspective and have something to say about something, whether it's as a subject matter expert or whatever it is, versus just, you know, trying to carve out space for the sake of carving out space.
Of course.
Yeah. the perspective that I've seen.
And that's something with like your success and our age, I'm assuming we're around the same age, you learn with time, right? When you're a young person just out of university and, you know, you're trying to get that entry level job and there's so much competition and you're just coming from a social environment where you've just kind of spent 8 years at school and you're trying to be like everybody else as a method of safety and survival, it's a tough thing to switch into. Later, of course, you become so proud of it, which it sounds like we both are and is amazing, but can be really tough to kind of get in the groove of.
Yeah, I think it's also, you know, coming from communities that are minority communities too, where we have been conditioned to really kind of assimilate and not stir up so much noise. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, entering in your experience, you know, Condé Nast or some sort of institutional organization where it is, you know, I would imagine very institutional, you know, how difficult was it to really, you know, separate yourself and really kind of carve out your own lane and not assimilate and really kind of, you know, advocate for yourself and your point of view, I guess?
That is such a good question, because I hope that the answer is motivating in that once I mentally got over that hurdle and decided to do it, it was so easy. The institution, the magazine, my editors, my bosses absolutely gave me so much space, to the point that I was shocked as a young editor to get a print column, a whole digital vertical, to be put on Good Morning America and the TV show, a clothing collection, all this stuff that I was, you know, 24 to 28 years old achieving. It was me who was in the way and no one else. And once I kind of got into the headspace that my size, my story, my difference was an asset and my team supported that, that's when I really saw the secret sauce start to be concocted.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't have a sauce metaphor.
Started cooking.
Yeah, started simmering, cooking, yeah.
So you oversaw the plus size beat in your role as editor at Glamour. I'm curious, how has the role of clothing in your life changed for you as either a source of armor or conversely one of vulnerability? Like, what role has that played for you? Especially being in the role that you were in at Glamour.
I think that clothing at first in my career was, gosh, you're so good at your job. wow, it's not often I'm stumped. This is an amazing. I think that it really was a thing to hide with and to try to not call attention to myself with. But at the same time, there weren't a lot of options in my size, which was 14 to 18, that helped me achieve that goal. And so if anyone listening is a plus size shopper and we're talking 10 to 6 years ago, you know, most things were dowdy cuts, terrible patterns, juvenile bright colors. And I wanted something that I ended up making, which was more like menswear, suiting, button downs, sharp pieces, timeless essentials, that made me feel on par with my peers. And so I guess it has changed in that I went and made it. And in that process has changed for me, because learning how clothes are made and the reasons why things don't exist or are made a certain way or are priced how they are has been revealed to me. And it's taken a lot of power out of clothing. So an example of that is I learned that factories cut clothing runs in sets of 7 for sizing. So that's why clothing stops at large at a size 12, 0, 2, 4, 6, you know, the math, 12, 14, around there.
Interesting. Okay.
Depending on where they start. And then the next set of 7 goes up to about size 24, which is where plus size clothing generally stops. And then if you wanted to add up to a size 30, which is a very, you know, healthy size for an inclusive brand, you actually have to pay as much to go up to whatever seven sizes above 24 is. So financially, the table doesn't make sense. And that's why arbitrarily fashion has always stopped around a size 14. Once I knew that, I stopped feeling so bad for being above a size 14, because it's not to say that there's some intrinsic value in being below that size. It's just that brands are either financially, lazy, or that's just the way it's always been done. So that's how they do it. And so I learned that lesson with grading, with fit modeling, with all these aspects of why clothing is how it is. And it helped me feel a lot better, because I realized the problem is not me or you or anybody and their body. It's the clothes.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because that actually is like directly tied to one of the questions I had coming up. And really, you know, I found it really kind of interesting, the dialogue that we, you know, sometimes see from brands about increasing size ranges, and to a large extent being more representative, whether that is size range or being, you know, skin color, whatever it might be, and how that requires innovation in order to be inclusive. Like, it requires some sort of wild new invention or like a Nobel Peace Prize in order to not dehumanize or other the overwhelming, what seems like the overwhelming majority of the market, which is my other question I was going to ask, is, you know, this idea of the plus size market being niche. I find that really an interesting thing to unpack, because I would argue that probably the majority of the North American audience probably fits within the majority of that, within the plus size, what the industry calls plus size. So, and it's not even really a question now. It's more of like an observation that I had, mm-hmm. that I just think it's interesting. So I guess from your perspective, as someone who also now runs her own fashion brand, you know, that is the kind of innovation that these brands are talking about. And it's really just more of, you know, efficiency. Yeah.
And listen, I was a journalist for many years in this space. And I also tend to not be hypercritical. And so I prefer to go solve the problem myself and give someone else answers by a critique. But it is easier said than done to be innovative when you're a new business, when you don't already have an entire machine that you need to overhaul in a lot of ways, financially, structurally, supply chain wise, to get the board or your investors on board. You know, it's so much easier to do that way. But yes, a lot of the problem with fashion, with beauty, with industries that affect how we feel about ourselves as people, is that they're run the way they've always been run, just because nobody wants to change anything. And that's that. And unfortunately, the status quo is not great. And so at Henning, you know, we only went up to a size 24 to start, but our attempt to be innovative was on each product page to have a request form with what size you would like, in what piece, if we didn't have it on offer. We reached out to those folks to give custom order pricing. We're transparent on the reasons financially why we couldn't add another set of seven sizes, because, you know, once we saw the data, it was that people really wanted two sizes higher. But we would have had to pay 7X. So you get that. And then we ended up, before the business was acquired, gearing towards made to order. And so you, Lance, would order a knit dress and it would be cut and sewn and packed up to you within 72 hours. And that was essentially going to lead to made to measure as well. So that when you did that, you put in your measurements. The dress was essentially sizeless and just for you, which would have been the innovation that took away all of that nasty stuff around sizing.
Yeah, yeah. I definitely want to talk about Henning as well. But focusing, just shifting towards your career as a model now, you know, you're a successful model on a really quick trajectory, and as well as a fashion brand entrepreneur. what does it mean to embrace the mindset of a model? Like, what are the core tenets of being a model that we can apply to our lives as non-models?
Oh my God, we have to go for coffee or drinks or something. We have so much conversation to have. But gosh, I love the way you think. I'm energized by this question because often it is positioned as such a frivolous thing to talk about. And I fell victim to that for a lot of years. I quote unquote hated being a model. I would never say that I did that to anybody. I always led with my more traditional, achievement-based roles or personality traits or what have you. And I have learned in recent years with a lot of therapy to be thankful for my job as a model because it has taught me a lot and it has allowed me financially, probably networking-wise as well, to do the things that I really, really care about and might not otherwise be able to just do.
Quiet bunny.
Like starting my own business, like taking a job as a freelance writer. And so the things that it has taught me personally are, okay. Yeah. Haley got it. It's okay. She's on guard. Sorry for the pause.
I love it.
That comparison is a killer.
Yeah.
Modeling is such a comparative industry and you're basically comparing what you look like to other people with the added factor of money. It is not good for you.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I keep getting steeped in that kind of taught me that I need to steer away from that as much as I can. I mean, I think that you could probably compare it to like a rock bottom type analogy. You get in a bad spot and you realize, whoa, this is not good. I don't want this. And so it has really made me be grounded in who I am, what I stand for, what I want, and to worry about myself. And it has also taught me that it's important to be multifaceted. It's important to have multiple interests and embrace the different sides of yourself. And so if a young model asks me for advice, my number one piece of advice is have something else going on. Don't just sit around waiting for other people to give you a job or a casting. Start writing, learn how to throw ceramics, go work with animals, volunteer with children, go back to school. Whatever you will make you feel fulfilled otherwise is really important to do. And yeah.
I think that's really interesting too, because, you know, today, especially, and especially because of social media, we've been able to see models really kind of embracing this entrepreneurial mindset and having these multifaceted identities so that it, you know, they're one identity or they don't have one identity. It's not tied down to one thing, but a diversity of things that kind of create this beautiful kind of mosaic around what it means to be a modern leader in an industry and a community today.
I think that seeing people who are models take back the power from what is traditionally a women's industry made by men is amazing. It speaks volumes about where we are as women in society. It speaks volumes about the dismantling of patriarchal capitalism and all that good stuff. And it's really exciting time to have people that have like one foot in the door of what's traditional and one foot in the door of what world they want to create. And the reason I say that is if I were a teenager today and I looked up to the people in the roles that I looked up to then now, I really feel like my personality would have been more positive earlier. I feel that I would have made a lot of different choices and might have arrived at this moment where I feel like me, I feel proud to be me. I feel like I'm in my groove with creating the world I want to create sooner.
Mm-hmm. And what inspired your initial move into modeling from your previous career?
Well, that's a great question, considering that I'm telling you that I hated it. I wanted to be a fashion editor. I wanted to be in publishing, and I wanted to do it in New York City because it's the epicenter. And I couldn't get a work visa because I didn't have enough work to show that as a recent Western grad at 21 or 22 years old, who had written for, you know, fashionmagazine.com and the school paper, that my work was so extraordinary that they had to outsource it to a Canadian. And I thought backwards into that logic and thought that if my job skill was what I looked like, I could technically prove that it was entirely unique. And so I went to an open call for the Ford Models Plus Size division and got signed that day. And it was really a means to an end. I really, really, really saw it as a throwaway means to an end that made me uncomfortable and insecure and comparative. And I did not like it.
But I feel like that's like almost shows kind of like some, you know, reflection on your entrepreneurial mindset in the sense of, you know, finding unique ways to tackle a problem as well, you know?
Yeah, I don't take no for an answer, that's for sure.
So earlier this year, you know, fast forward, you became the first openly queer plus size Sports Illustrated rookie, which is what they call first time swimsuit issue model. Yes. What did that opportunity mean for you from a career standpoint? And also, why did you choose that as a platform to share that message?
That question is perfectly put together because they go hand in hand. I came out, for those who have not read, in the issue of Sports Illustrated Swimsuit this year. And before that, the first time I had really talked about it beyond my friends and family was in my casting video for the magazine. And I sat down to do my self-tape, and I have my little spiel that I have gotten used to. It's, hi, I'm Lauren Chan. I'm a fashion editor and brand entrepreneur, and I care about size inclusion in fashion, blah, 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 blah. And when I sat down to do that, I felt called to share a more personal story. The one, as I mentioned, of coming out and getting divorced and living in a new chapter. And I think that I felt moved to do so because Sports Illustrated Swimsuit celebrates the folks that they include in the magazine holistically. I think that they represent so many kinds of folks, which is incredible. And they've been able to move the culture forward with it. At the same time, I thought that the makeup and reach of their audience could use some queer joy or some representation. And I thought that the timing was pivotal. When the issue came out, there was and is a record number of anti-LGBTQ bills in the United States being brought forth by state legislatures. And the last I looked, the number was over 500. And for all those reasons, I just felt like that was the right time and place. And I guess it resonated because here we are. And I got to write my own essay and have it in my own words. And then have all these moments afterwards where we're talking about it, which is to me so important. So it was right. Yeah.
Is that a mantle that you, you know, are, that energizes you, and a responsibility that you feel, you know, compelled to, you know, take on as kind of a community leader and someone that has a voice and influence?
I don't know about compelled, but I certainly do everything with purpose. And I do everything with purpose, but I only do things that require purpose. And so I think that being an advocate for size inclusion in fashion is a perfect example of that. You know, I can't just write about Canadian tuxedos. I have to have something about it that means something to who I am as a person and means something to the folks who read it or buy it, and affects our lives positively and makes, therefore, the world a better place. And so, you know, if I was going to be on a platform like Sports Illustrated Swimsuit, I'm certainly glad I have something that I care so deeply about to, you know, be talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. I can only imagine that sharing that message on a platform, like coming out in and of itself is a terrifying, you know, can be a terrifying experience. And I can only imagine doing so on an international platform like that must have at least been a little bit nerve-wracking, I can imagine. But what real, you know, what gives you courage? Like, what gives you the courage to really kind of stand up for your ideas and tackle scary problems and scale daunting mountains?
I think it's important to me to make a difference in the world. Maybe that's the Canadian in me. But I think on a more practical level, every time that I have been vulnerable or courageous or shared something that has made me feel insecure, those have been the moments that have led to the greatest success, connection, personal love at every turn. And so just habitually, like just biologically, I have learned that that tends to be the right path for me. That tends to be the right move. And I'm glad I'm wired that way, I guess.
I'm also curious, what role, because, you know, fashion industry, the modeling industry, media, there's a lot of, you know, there can be a lot of institutionalized cultures, you know. And so what role has the word no played in the trajectory of your career? And conversely, what role has the word yes played?
Yeah, I think that no used to intimidate me a lot. And now if someone says no when there's data to back something up, when the culture is clearly trending in a certain way or has proof of concept for whatever it is that I'm working on or feeling, when I feel in my gut and I can trust myself that it's the right thing, I just know that's a sign that that person is not the right person for me to work with, or be associated with, or it's not the right way to do something. It is a favor to me at this point because I don't waste time barking up that tree. I think that the more, and I'm sure you feel this too, that I've been able to create the work that I want to and move the world in the way that I want it to move and feel like power, I think there's a way to accomplish whatever you want to accomplish. And no is just a hint along the way that that's not the path.
Yeah.
You can make your own yes. There's 100 ways to make something happen. No is a help.
Yeah.
No is a hint.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I've been listening to, the podcast that Julia Louis-Dreyfus has. Have you listened to it?
Yes, why is it in me?
It's so good. And, you know, she interviews women that are in their 60s and up. And a theme that I noticed is that the word no can be a complete sentence. And I thought that to be quite powerful too, because there's no ifs, buts, ands, or follow up. It's just no. And I think it doesn't have to, I just thought that that was actually really interesting and a really interesting observation from these incredible individuals as well.
I think it's really smart to acknowledge that no isn't just something said to you. It's something that you can say as well. And so I think exactly from that point of view, no can be a full sentence. You can say that you don't agree with the way something's being done and you don't want to be involved. And you can also say no to the way that something's being done and go make a better way yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What do you think is the most interesting thing happening in fashion today from your perspective?
Ooh. Well, like, not to get freaky or technical, but I'm really interested in what AI is going to do to fashion across the board. But I think we're at a serious turning point in fashion where young talent is about to truly revolutionize the industry. I think we've been on the precipice of it for a while, but we're really seeing a lot of industry juggernauts not doing so well. And I think that at the height that we're at of diversity, and social media and transparency in fashion, the young folks are really prime for a takeover.
Yeah, changing of the guard of sorts. Yeah. And, you know, obviously you're a Canadian that has walked on global runway and worked in American media, in the American media ecosystem. What do you think is Canada's unique point of view on fashion?
I think that Canada's unique point of view on anything is diversity and good for everyone and not just the self. And so I'm very, very proud to be Canadian. I'm very, very proud to be part of the Canadian fashion ecosystem as well. I've been really trying to make a concerted effort to insert myself at home this year. And so, just being with some new agencies in Canada, returning to clients that I adore, and being involved with CAFA, whether through the Fairmont Royal York's Grand Estate in Fashion or today just being nominated.
Yes, congratulations.
Awards. Thank you. I'm like fiercely proud to be Canadian.
Yeah, yeah. Building on that, you know, it was announced earlier that you'll be walking the runway for the grandest night of fashion at the Fairmont Royal York in Toronto, which I personally love. They have a wonderful, wonderful lobby bar that I frequent quite often. It's in partnership with Canadian Arts and Fashion Awards, which is our biggest industry accolade. Do you have any Canadian designers that you absolutely stand by and love and adore? Are there any emerging voices that you love? Not even just designers, but I guess talent in the industry overall?
Yes, definitely. Excuse me, I'm just taking a sip of water. Yes, definitely. I am always in awe of Tanya Taylor and what she's been able to accomplish globally. I am really, really into Golsha as an emerging designer. And if this comes out before the CAFA Awards, I really want to wear something. So I'll be in touch. And then talent-wise, I mean, everyone is so amazing. I love Miles Sexton, and I'm so excited to walk alongside them in the show. Also, just the fact that it's like a room that includes Miles and Jeannie Becker.
Icon.
And all these amazing folks. It's iconic. And so I went through the list of CAFA nominations and sent congratulatory texts to some of my friends who are nominated, but everyone from like Sasha Exeter to Olivia LeBlanc, to a bunch of. It's just such an incredible group to be a part of.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of a brand created by a Canadian, can you tell me a little bit more about Henning as well? What's your elevator pitch to the world?
Okay, so Henning's elevator pitch to the world is that we made luxury, ethical clothing for folks size 12 and up. We focused on suiting and outerwear to make you feel peak powerful.
And based on your experience building a business, what questions do you think all, you know, leaders, entrepreneurs, bosses should be asking themselves before they start building a company?
Do you really want to do this?
Right.
Yeah, it's not going to be easy. So you have to really want with every fiber in your body to do it. And you have to be honest. I have been in this position so many times, and Henning and coming out in Sports Illustrated were the two times in, you know, the last 5 years that I felt every fiber in my body screaming, yes. There are other opportunities, of course, that I've had and done that I've had to convince myself a little to buck up and do. And I know you all know that feeling. Starting a company is one where you need the every fiber in your body feeling.
Right, right.
Go ahead. And then I was going to say, you know, and then there are some other questions that are best answered before you start, which are why you?
Yeah.
Why now? What's different?
Yeah, yeah. No, I was just about to ask.
And what's the actual business plan?
Right, right.
How are you making money?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask, like, what do you wish you knew before you became a business owner?
Well, that said, I think it was better that I didn't really understand the full grasp of what I was getting myself into, because I might not have jumped off the cliff. You know, I might not have been so free and motivated and energized. I might have been a little more trepidatious.
Yeah. I mean, I think that seems to be a common theme with a lot of the entrepreneurs that we talk to, especially ones that have built their first businesses. If they knew what they had, you know, now know going into a business, they might not have done it. And sometimes that little bit of blind optimism is a good thing and is required before you start a business.
I am excited to be a second time founder. That was something I got asked a lot in my early conversations. Are you a first time founder? And when I am eventually a second time founder, I will not be the only person in the C-suite from the jump. I'll tell you that. I will have a CFO or a COO.
Right.
I will likely be like chief creative officer or something like that.
Right, right. And so recently the company also got acquired. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Was that always part of the plan?
Yes. I am so happy that Henning was acquired by Universal Standard, because it's the perfect home. Universal Standard is the most size inclusive brand in the world. We make sizes 00 to 40. And I also just have such a wonderful personal history with the co-founders and the business. And so it really was right. It was one of those moments where everything just felt like 110% yes. And so, yeah, now I'm working on partnerships there and trying to expand the reach of the business as much as I can. But it's an incredible home and the business is profitable. So
congratulations. Wow. How did you manifest success for yourself? Are you the type of entrepreneur that really likes to, you know, visualize the road ahead and kind of ultimately the acquisition? Like, what was that experience like for you?
I don't know that I manifest that, but I do think that's something that helped me along the way is that I am never unkind to anybody. And if I don't agree or like you very much or don't think your idea is a good idea, whatever it is, I never ever, maybe because I'm Canadian, will be anything less than kind about it. And I think that that kept a lot of doors open for me, whether that was being able to walk back into my old employer and have a bunch of the magazines cover my launch, being able to sell the business to essentially a competitor in the end. And so I didn't necessarily have like a manifestation habit, but I think that not closing any doors and burning any bridges kept a bunch of opportunities open.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And, you know, what have you learned from your experience in media and at Henning about cultivating community, and what's the key to building one?
I think vulnerability is the key to building a genuine community that either A, actually helps you as an individual and makes you feel safe and seen and celebrated and all that good stuff. Or if you're looking at it from a business point of view, actually buys what you're selling and engages with your content. And so, you know, as I was saying earlier, I've really learned that being vulnerable and being courageous and sometimes taking a leap of faith and sharing insecurities has brought me folks who feel like me, whether that's friends or community or followers or customers or listeners. And they're the people who I want to be speaking to and making things for and spending time with. So yeah, the key to community, the right community, is vulnerability.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Just as we wrap up here, and I want to, if I can steal a little bit of your time before we wrap, to do maybe a rapid fire. But the last question that we usually end off on for our interviews is, you know, as I mentioned before, we really focus on mission and purpose driven entrepreneurs and companies. And so what's your mission at the end of the day?
My mission at the end of the day is to make the world a better place through representation and conversation and product and content for folks who have been left out and excluded, like me. And so that used to be through the lens of size, and it's also becoming through the lens of being Asian Canadian and part of the gay community, and a female entrepreneur, and a bunch of other stuff that makes me and the people in the same boat feel like part of my family.
I love that. Thank you so much for your chat and your insight. And I've honestly just really enjoyed our conversation here. And it feels like just a conversation between friends more than an interview. So thank you for your time.
Of course. We have to go to the lobby bar at the Fairmont.
Yes. And continue. Yeah, 100%. Okay, if I can do a quick rapid fire with you. Rapid-ish fire. Let's see. Paris or Milan?
Paris.
Toronto or Vancouver?
Toronto.
Spring, summer or fall, winter?
Fall, winter.
I agree. If you were on the planning committee of the Met Gala, what theme would you like to see, and what would your celebrity, or who would your celebrity co-chair be?
Oh my God, isn't that a rapid fire?
I know, a rapid-ish fire.
Celebrity co-chair RuPaul. Theme. They already did camp, but they didn't do it well. So we would do camp the way that queens do.
Love it. Love it. You're setting your dream dinner party. Who's attending? And what are you serving?
I am serving Chinese food. I have to.
Love.
And who's attending? You, me, Daria Wervoy. She's back. Canadian supermodel for Gucci High. So I can't wait to see her out and doing more. Who else do I love? Dua Lipa, Sasha Exeter.
It's a fun party.
Who else is really wonderful? Who would you invite? You can be celebrity co-chair of the dinner.
Oh gosh, no, you cannot flip this around on me. Oh gosh, I don't, you know what? Sometimes it's funny. I never get asked my own questions, so I don't even have the answers to my own stuff right now.
Go ahead.
Let's see. Best fashion party memory?
Best fashion party memory. I think it's going to be the Fashion Magazine party in September, celebrating the September issue that I got to write something for.
Love it. Love it. If you were to write a memoir, what would the name of your memoir be?
I don't know.
we'll pause and save it for later. Do you have an item in your closet that has a really good story behind it?
I'm sure. An item in my closet that has a really good story behind it. In my closet, I have the original Henning samples. And so... naturally, I think that is just going to stay there forever and remind me of that time and, give me the confidence that I can do whatever I set my mind to.
Yeah, absolutely. What's a productivity hack that you have?
Know when you work best. I work best from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. and not outside of those hours.
Love it. And last one, what's the biggest career win for you so far?
Wow. My biggest career win, I will say, is having my business Henning acquired. I'm just so proud, and I need a lot of time before I start a business again. but I'm really, really, really thrilled with how it turned out.
I love it. Thank you so much. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know what you liked, who you'd like to see on the show, and anything else you want to share. To keep up to date, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen to your podcasts. Until next time, ask yourself, what's your mission?